This is Pacifica Radio, KPFK, 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, 98.7 FM, Santa Barbara.
Live with a Black South African care for 1 second about a war in Europe when they are under European imperialism and racism. They see World War II as a huge opportunity to sort of make more money, right? Because suddenly South Africa is pivotal to the British Empire. And so they struck for wage increases, but everyone understood that when black workers demonstrate power, it's a threat to white supremacy. And so we should always understand that any strike during the apartheid era has more than one immediate short-term economic consequence.
Good memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down.
Good morning and welcome to another working week. This is KPFK's Working Voices. I'm your host, Joe Ayala, president of NABIT CWA Local 53.
And I'm your co-host, Marissa Remsky of CWA Local 9003.
And in this morning's show, Steve Zelzer, Labor Media, presents labor historian Peter Cole lecturing on Southern African and international solidarity with the ILWU. Spanish United's Enrique Sanchez interviews Liam LaFontaine, the mayor of Biddleford, Maine, about the ICE killing of Juan Sebastian Guerrero. Kristen Parker has this week's Education Workers Report card on AI versus California's AB 2148. And our associate producer, Hal Lohr, looks at the U.S. economy and the national debt on this morning's Working Voices update. All this and more coming up this morning on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. This is Working Voices.
For our first offering this morning, Steve Zelzer from his Labor Video YouTube channel presents an ILWU lecture from labor historian Peter Cole about how dock workers in South Africa under apartheid helped spark a movement toward international solidarity and what it means to the ILWU and today's global labor struggle.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to come back to Laborfest. It's always a pleasure to speak as part of this very cool month-long series of events about labor history and labor politics in our time. Like Steve Zelzer mentioned, I'm a historian, so I'm going to talk to you about the past, but hopefully you'll understand how the past and the present come together in a whole bunch of different ways. The title that I was given in South African ILWU Local 10, Connections, History, and Relevance, is a great title because it sort of really does what I hope to do over the next 20 or 30 minutes. So the way I like to often begin is to highlight the fact that the maritime world is central to the global capitalist economy and has been since the birth of the global capitalist economy. And that's super important to appreciate for multiple reasons. And the example I love to give is even the word that we use in English to describe work stoppages, the word strike, right? It's a nautical term and it means when you take down the sails of a ship. And so basically in 1768, when London, England was the biggest port in the world, sailors sailing into London Harbor on the Thames River took down the sails of their ship because they wanted a raise, which is to say they struck their sails. They won a raise, and subsequently the term striking a sail became the word that we all use in the English language to describe not just the work stoppages of sailors, but the work stoppages of all workers, right? And that tells us how important maritime is or nautical is to the economy overall. right? In fact, without ships, Europe wouldn't have come to dominate the world over the last half millennium. It was pivotal, in other words, to the rise of capitalism, to the rise of then the conquest of the world, which is to say imperialism, right? As well as the transatlantic slave trade, right? And so if we think about the centrality of maritime, we also know that that's the case in our time. So keeping that in mind, I also love to highlight the fact that those who work in the industry are fascinating people, right? That maritime workers are different than a lot of other workers because, for one, they're very cosmopolitan. What that means is that they are often exposed to people who are different than themselves, from different places, with different ideas, right? Who also bring information from other parts of the world, right? Although there's lots of different people who are cosmopolitan, and although cosmopolitan does not automatically result in you being embracing different people and cultures, it means you're exposed, right, in ways that often in smaller towns or sort of less like port-like cities don't have. Now, in particular, for people of African descent, for Black dock workers and Black seafarers, there's also this notion of pan-Africanism, which is to say that people from Africa are connected to people who are in Africa still, right? So people in the Caribbean, people in North America, people in South America or other parts of the world who are of African descent are connected to their home place, right? That means pan or across Africanism. And there's a lot of different examples, but the two I give here are a legendary man from Senegal named Ousmane Sembène, who is one of the great artists of the second half of the 20th century. He was a dock worker in Marseille, France, before he became a successful author and filmmaker, right? Or the Jamaican on the right, Claude McKay, who is one of the leaders of the Harlem Renaissance, right? And who wrote important novels and poems in the 1920s and 1930s, right? And was a sailor, right? Or that image in the middle, which is African-Americans in Harlem in the 1930s who protested against the Italian invasion of Ethiopia in 1935. These are all examples of pan-Africanism, but also how Black maritime workers are very much sort of embrace these ideas. Now, talk a little about South Africa for a second. I'm going to use Robert F. Kennedy, the original Robert F. Kennedy, not the jerk that we currently have to deal with, right? So then U.S. Senator Robert F. Kennedy visited South Africa in the year 1966, after his brother had been killed, before Kennedy, of course, would be killed in California 2 years later when he was running for president. In his week-long visit to South Africa, he met Albert Luthuli, who was the head of the African National Congress, but had been banned, which is to say that he was forced to be silenced inside his own country. He also was the first South African to win the Nobel Peace Prize, right? So in the words of Robert F. Kennedy, when he spoke at the University of Cape Town in 1966, "I came here, Cape Town, because of my deep interest in and affection for a land settled by the Dutch in the mid-17th century, then taken over by the British and at last independent. A land in which the native inhabitants were at first subdued, but relations with whom remain a problem to this day. A land which defined itself on a hostile frontier. A land which has tamed rich natural resources through the energetic application of modern technology. A land which once imported slaves and now must struggle to wipe out the last traces of that former bondage. I refer, of course, to the United States of America." Now, that's really brilliant, whoever wrote that speech, if it wasn't Kennedy, because he's talking in South Africa. What I just described is actually South African history, but it's also American history, right? And so for many of us, myself included, who think, what's the deal with comparing or thinking about these two countries' connections? The answer is that they share a tremendous amount in common. I'd also like to introduce a few other concepts that I think are really important for thinking about the past and the present. One is this notion of labor internationalism, the collective actions of a group of workers in one country who set aside their short-term interests as a national group on behalf of a group of workers in another country in order to promote their long-term interests as members of a transnational class. Black internationalism could be defined as a global political, intellectual, and artistic movement of African-descended people engaged in the collective struggle to overthrow global white supremacy in its many forms. Now, we're going to see how both ILWU Local 10, but also other unions, including in South Africa, have embraced these concepts, gives the power and the language to understand what to do and how we might do them. So diving into some of the history, So in 1935, Italy, which was fascist, right, ruled by Benito Mussolini, invaded Ethiopia. When Italy invaded Ethiopia, dock workers in Durban refused to load food aboard an Italian ship that was intended for the Italian army in Italy. The following year, members of what became ILWU Local 10, which actually ILWU wasn't born until 1937 officially, right, did the same thing, right, around May Day of 1936. Right. And so these are examples of workers refusing to work cargo in order to protest the politics of something in another place. This is labor internationalism and or Black internationalism in action. Now, who are these workers in Durban? Right. And so they're all Black Africans, but they come from different ethnic groups. So in the 1940s and 50s, actually, Durban dockers repeatedly struck, including during and after World War II. Why would a Black South African care for one second about a war in Europe? Right. When they are under European imperialism and racism. Right. And so they see World War II as a huge opportunity to sort of make more money. Right. Because suddenly South Africa is pivotal to the British Empire. And so they struck for wage increases. But everyone understood that when Black workers demonstrate power, it's a threat to white supremacy. And so we should always understand that any strike during the apartheid era has more than one immediate short-term economic consequence. That's why a group called the Congress of the Democrats, which is essentially a front for the Communist Party after it had been banned in South Africa, declared a victory for the dock workers as a victory for the entire working class. But this is not unique to South Africa. So dock workers in Mombasa in British East Africa, which is now Kenya, were also pivotal to the Kenyan independence struggle in the 50s and 60s. In West Africa, railroad workers were really important in what became Senegal and other parts of French West Africa. In other words, what I'm talking about primarily in South Africa, these sorts of things are happening in other parts of the decolonizing parts of Africa. But to focus especially on South Africa, so one of the most famous events in the post-World War II era was called the Sharpeville Massacre, where dozens of Black men and women were murdered by the South African police for peacefully protesting against the pass laws, which required all Black people to carry a pass with them wherever they went. Right. In the aftermath of the Sharpeville Massacre, which was a internationally covered event, the African National Congress started to call upon people around the world to boycott South African products in order to protest apartheid. In the words of Luthuli, not banned yet in 1960, economic boycott is one way in which the world at large can bring home to South African authorities that they must either mend their ways or suffer for them. In the United States, probably the most important African Liberation Solidarity organization in the 50s and 60s was called the American Committee on Africa. They also called for U.S. consumers to boycott South African goods and called on the U.S. government to sanction South Africa, although that would take another 25 years. Meanwhile, dock workers, who could be considered strategic because of their location in the national and global economy, are starting to think about engaging in work stoppages. However, the mainstream Western, in the Cold War era, the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, opposed boycotts, as did the International Transport Worker Federation, which is still around today, the ITF. However, some dock workers rejected these more moderate stances and engaged in boycotts. 1960 is the first time we start to see boycotts in solidarity with the anti-apartheid struggle. This is not unique, however, to African or Black workers, right? In, for example, Australia and New Zealand, also in 1960, dock workers and maritime workers, including seafarers, also engage in work stoppages. And so that's important to do, keeping in mind that Australia and New Zealand, like South Africa, and like the United States, and like Canada, were British colonial settler societies. Back in Durban, dock workers, even though they are not allowed to be in a union, even though they are not allowed to be on strike, are actually actively involved in the anti-apartheid movement, including the armed underground led by a man named Nelson Mandela, who was the best known member of the Spear of the Nation, also called in English MK. Back in San Francisco, at the hall that is named after now William Bilchester, right. Bill Chester worked with one of the leaders in the American Committee on Africa. The white woman named Mary Louise Hooper was the first union to refuse to work South African cargo. So the way this worked was that Hooper and Chester, based on my research, knew each other from civil rights circles in San Francisco, where Hooper also lived and was an active member of the local NAACP. They essentially coordinate the action so that Hooper throws up a small group of pickets, middle-aged white and black people, 20 people from the NAACP and CORE, right? And Chester, aware that this is happening, told them which ship, what dock, what time the ship was going to come in, a Dutch ship with South African cargo. And then all the guys, but respect that picket for the day and the night shifts, right? And this is the first documented case of American workers of any sort, not just dock workers, refusing to work cargo. This story actually got picked up nationally, so the Associated Press covered it, right? And so all around the country, people were reading in late 1962 about this action on the San Francisco waterfront when, for the first time, members of Local 10 refused to work South African cargo. Back in South Africa, a few years later, Vuyusile Mini, who is a Xhosa, he was a dock worker, second generation from Port Elizabeth, which is on the southern coast of Africa. That's in the Indian Ocean. Mini was a leader in his union. He was also a leader in the local ANC and the MK. And Mini was also a songwriter and singer, right? He was actually executed by the state of South Africa for his songs. And he literally was singing one of his songs as he was walked to the gallows in Pretoria in 1964. And the song that he was singing was one of his songs, which in English is called Watch Out Verwoerd, who was one of the architects of apartheid, right? And a more famous South African woman named Miriam Makeba would sing this song to countless audiences over the 30 years that she lived in exile from 1960 into the 1990s. So Minnie was one of the first actual South Africans to be executed for being an anti-apartheid activist. And if you ever saw a documentary film called Amandla, Revolution in Four-Part Harmony, which is about the role of music in the anti-apartheid struggle, it begins with the story of Vuyusile Mini.
You're listening to Working Voices on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Now, this was called the Quiet Decade in South Africa because there was so much repression that for a number of years, activism inside the country diminished greatly. However, dock workers in Durban, which was and still is the biggest port in South Africa and the busiest port in sub-Saharan Africa, started to organize despite the repression. And so in 1969 and in 1972, dockers went on strike in Durban, despite the fact that almost no one else in the country was doing these sorts of things. A few months later, as a few of us know, because like a few of us were there, right? In January of 1973, black workers in what was called the Coronation Brick Factory went on strike, and they inspired workers in dozens of other factories and industries in the greater Durban area to go out on strike, which becomes known as the Durban Strikes, a series of actions that included both Black and Indian members of the working class, and was the largest strike in the apartheid era up until that point. And I actually have done a lot of work and argue that the dockers were pivotal to essentially laying the groundwork for the larger Durban Strikes. Back in the United States, in South Africa, in San Francisco, in 1976, students in Soweto rose up in what becomes a crucial event in 1970 South Africa, but also the anti-apartheid movement, right? When they rose up to protest basically the teaching of Afrikaans, the language of the oppressor, in their schools. In the aftermath of the student uprising in Soweto, which spread across the country, Leo Robinson and a number of other members of Local 10 convinced their fellow workers in Local 10 to establish what's called the Southern Africa Liberation Support Committee. It was committed to freedom not only in South Africa, but also Portuguese-controlled colonies in Southern Africa, as well as the sort of the Namibia, which was Southwest Africa. They convinced the shipping companies somehow to donate two free containers and ship them. And the workers raised tons of food and medicine and other supplies and shipped them to Dar es Salaam, right, to be distributed to freedom fighters who were in exile from South Africa who lived in Tanzania. Really incredible story. Fast forward a few years, 1984, Ronald Reagan wins a landslide re-election. A few weeks later, dock workers in San Francisco refuse to unload the ship here. Now, just the previous month, members of the Southern Africa Liberation Support Committee had screened the film called The Last Grave at Dimbaza to the members of Local 10 at their monthly meeting. Let's just say it's not very common that at a union meeting that you watch an hour-long documentary about what's happening in another country. Right? This film is really amazing because after you watch this hour-long film, you understand why apartheid is so horrible and you want to do something about it. And so in the aftermath of the screening of this film at Local 10's hall, Leo raises his hand and says we should stop working the next ship that comes in with South African cargo. Howard Keeler makes an amendment, Howard says we should strike ships, amendments made to sort of only sort of refuse to work South African cargo, right? And then a few weeks later, this Dutch ship, the Ned Lloyd Kimberley, sails into San Francisco Harbor and actually docks on the San Francisco side, even though most of the work by then is in Oakland. What is Dimbaza? It's actually a small township in the Eastern Cape. It's a desperately poor place. And I actually got a chance to visit Dimbaza last year for the first time. It was very powerful because before that, it had just been a place on the map. The anti-apartheid movement inside South Africa and worldwide is surging in the mid and late 1980s. And in 1990, a number of political prisoners, including the most famous one, Nelson Mandela, is released from prison. The ANC and other political parties that had been banned in the 60s are unbanned. And it will take four more years, but basically apartheid is coming to a close. It's collapsing. Just a few months after Mandela is freed from prison with his second wife, pictured here, Winnie, Nelson Mandela takes a tour of the United States. He actually toured a great many countries in the 90s. I think he visited Cuba, actually, before he visited the United States. Right? But he spent 10 days in the United States in the summer of 1990. Final stop on that tour was in Oakland, California, at the Oakland Coliseum before 50,000 people with Ron Dellums emceeing. Ron Dellums, whose father was a member of Local 10, and Ron Dellums, who was the most well-known and important Black activist in Congress supporting the struggle against apartheid, gives a speech, right? And Nelson Mandela devotes a significant part of his speech to thanking members of LW Local 10 for their actions in previous years, an important moment. Back in South Africa, dock workers are organizing unions, which are starting to become illegal for Black workers. By the year 2000, apartheid ends in 1994. The South African Transport and Allied Workers Union is founded. That's, in other words, not just for maritime workers, but other workers in logistics, truck and rail. You can make a good argument that the entire industry should be in a single union instead of divided into multiple unions. This is really industrial unionism in concept, right? Of course, they have the same motto as the IWW and the LW, an injury one is an injury to all. And this is an important growing time in Durban. Right. In 2008, when a ship from China comes in with weapons intended for the neighboring landlocked country of Zimbabwe, which was in the midst of an election campaign in which the leader, Robert Mugabe, who had long been using oppression to maintain power, his opponent in that election in 2008 was a union leader named Morgan Tsvangirai. Right. He had been beaten up by Zimbabwean police. The ship comes in with weapons and ammunition intended for Zimbabwe. And Durban dock workers say, we're not going to unload a ship because literally these guns and bullets are going to be used to kill Zimbabwean workers just across the border. Keeping in mind that that border was a British created border and that, in fact, there are people of the exact same ethnic groups on both sides of the Zimbabwe-South African border. Right. They also were very appreciative of that before the end of apartheid, that Zimbabwe was often a safe haven for South Africans in exile. I would be remiss if I didn't try to bring this more to the present, right? And so I want to highlight how important the struggle for Palestinian freedom and statehood is within the history of the LW, right? In the 1980s and the 1990s, the LW at its international convention on several occasions passed resolutions condemning Israel for its quote unquote apartheid policies. This is 30 years before apartheid was often and much more widely understood to be put into practice by Israel against Palestine, right? And one of the leaders of those efforts in the 80s and 90s was Leo Robinson, right? Who pushed very hard in the mid-90s conventions. Fast forward into the 20-teens, right, in the Port of Oakland, right, on a number of occasions, Local 10 members coordinated with Arab American and other community activists to protest Israeli-owned ships from the Zim Line, Z-I-M, right, which regularly or occasionally docked in the Port of Oakland and other U.S. ports, right? This was a successful action in 2014, sorry. We're all thinking about the last couple of years in Palestine and Israel. Let's just say the ILWU has not yet committed itself to taking as principled stand as it did in the past. And, well, we could talk about that too. I would note that in South Africa, overwhelming support for Palestine exists. Palestinians look to South Africans to be like brothers and sisters, right? When South Africans see Palestine and how Palestinians are treated in their homes, they see South African apartheid, right? And so for them, it's a really easy decision to make to support the notion of Palestinian freedom. I also like to highlight, among other things about the ILWU, that four of the greatest Black people of the 20th century were connected to and honorary members of the ILWU. Now, when Nelson Mandela came in 1990, he was inducted as an honorary member of ILWU Local 10. Before him, in 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. visited the hall, Local 10, and was made an honorary member and gave an important speech the year before he was murdered. Paul Robeson was a buddy with Harry Bridges and was an honorary member of the ILWU, right? And most recently, Angela Davis received honorary membership in the ILWU Local 10 in 2021. If I think about the fact that King, Robeson, and Davis are all intimately tied to and allies with the ILWU and Local 10, I honestly can't think of three more important Black people in American history in modern times who are more principled, but it's no coincidence that their closest union ties are with the ILWU. I could go on, but my time's up. I do want to close by saying that what I'm talking about in the past is still true in the present, right? That dock workers and other workers in the supply chain, truckers, warehouse workers, railroad workers, et cetera, are all part of the global supply chain, and that they are therefore, I like to say, as many have before me, we know the phrase, the sort of a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Another way to think about that is that the weakest link is where workers are strongest, right? Now, it just so happens to be in the global supply chain, it's dock workers, but there's no reason that workers in other parts of the supply chain couldn't be as strong, right? Except that they're not yet as organized. I do like to highlight also that dock workers in the Bay Area, but also in many other places, have long histories of labor and Black internationalism. But specifically, that the ILWU has been connected to and stood in solidarity with South Africa going back to 1960, actually the late 1950s. And so that is a multi-generational relationship, which is of tremendous importance and worthy of our attention and respect. So I thank everyone for their attention and again, for the chance to address people in ILWU Local 10's hall, named after the one and only Bill Chester. Thank you very much.
That was Steve Zeltzer from his Labor Video YouTube channel. For more videos and insights from Steve Zeltzer, you can go to his Labor Video YouTube channel, or now you can find him at the Production of Labor Video Project on the web at labormedia.net.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres llorona que yo.
As we start the bottom half of the hour this morning, we go to Working Voices contributor Enrique Sanchez from Spanish United for his interview with Biberford, Maine Mayor Liam LaFontaine, as he discusses last week's shooting of Juan Sebastian Guerrero, a 26-year-old Colombian man, by federal immigration agents.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to Spanish United Radio. I'm your host, Enrique Sanchez. We have a special guest. Can you introduce yourself, please, to the audience?
Yes, my name is Liam LaFountain. I'm the mayor of the city of Biddeford.
Welcome. Thank you for being a guest on the show.
Thanks for having me.
As per se, that when I contacted you in the email, we wanted to discuss about the current situation, what's going on in the city of Biddeford, and the recent tragedy with the unlawful killing of John Sebastian Guerrero. So as mayor, can you explain a little bit of what's going on, the status and the current situation there in the city?
Well, it's a deeply sad state right now in the city. People are in mourning. People are frustrated. They're angry. This community is very tight knit. We have a strong immigrant community, a strong immigrant history. And this death has hit us very hard.
Yeah, I'm very disturbed because I myself, as a Hispanic community activist, one of my duties is to advocate for the Hispanic community. And as you know, with this current situation that's happening in the country, many Hispanic people feel that there was a persecution. And this is the second ICE shooting since the one that happened last week with Lorenzo Salgado over in Houston, Texas. So my question is, how is the family coming along? Have you spoken to the family or anyone related to them?
I've been in constant contact with a representative for the family, you know, obviously doing whatever we can to support them. I wouldn't speak any further on the family. I'll leave that for their representatives to speak for themselves and give them the space that they're asking for.
No, that's fine. The reason why I asked, because I'm trying to get a hold of the Salgado family. So off the record, if you're able to get me in contact with the representative, I would greatly appreciate it.
Okay, we can talk offline.
Sure, not a problem. So explain how the people are able to cope with this situation, with this tragedy. How are the people able to cope? Because I know that on the news, there's been mixed reaction. Most people have been positive, but then you have a minority that justify it. So how is the community able to deal with this recent tragedy?
Well, in the evening after the killing, residents across Biddeford and across Maine came to Mechanics Park, which is just down the street from the site of the incident, and were protesting. And there was a very large turnout in the hundreds of people that were looking out and, you know, supporting immigrants in our state and his family as well. So that's been part of the response. And then you also have an activation of networks that were formed back in January when the federal government and ICE were doing their Operation Catch of the Day. And many immigrants in our community were struggling and weren't feeling safe coming out of their homes. We're seeing that again now. But there are networks, mutual aid organizations, and local immigrant organizations like the Maine Immigrant Rights Coalition, an umbrella organization that works with many immigrants to be able to provide support. And the city itself, we are partnering with mental health providers to ensure that we're getting resources to individuals where they need it, for those in the neighborhood, for those who may have observed or witnessed either the shooting or the aftermath, and just anyone impacted to be able to have the resources for them there. You also see, you know, stand up food pantry and food distributions going on. So there's efforts to meet basic human needs, emotional needs, and to try and support those reeling from this tragedy.
Right. Because I also read on the news that, you know, when the tragedy happened, Mr. Guerrero was not the person they were looking for. So do you believe it was a mistaken identity where they may have found his address of a previous person they were looking for, and then they targeted him?
I wouldn't speculate on what ICE was doing, but I have heard the same reports that he was not the individual that was a target for, he was not the target on the warrant. And that's just devastating because, you know, this all could have been preventable.
Absolutely.
And it's a tragedy in our city, in our state, and our country. And I know there are many people I've heard from in Colombia that are frustrated and, you know, really an international incident.
Well, yeah, because, you know, this is becoming like a reoccurring pattern where you have agents that do not have like a marked car, you know, they are in plain clothing. So it's like, how do people who, you know, who are not committing crimes are able to comply if they don't identify themselves? Like this is like the same tactic that I'm seeing, you know, everywhere, not just in Maine, but also in Texas.
That's why I'm calling for and working with our federal delegation for, you know, the traffic stops to stop, make that permanent. The Secretary Mullen announced that they were going to be temporary stopping those. I think that was one step, but to permanently stop would be safer for our communities. You know, the tactics have to change.
Well, absolutely, because, you know, it's getting to be where it's judge, jury, and executioners. Like, where is the due process?
Yeah, and that's why we're advocating for a full, thorough, and transparent investigation, because we need to get to the hard and fast facts of this case, a timeline. And that's why we want involvement from Maine law enforcement, who people trust.
How do you feel that the city will move on from this tragedy?
It won't be quickly. It will take a lot of time. It will take resources. There will need to be a lot of healing, which is going to happen at a different pace for everybody. We're going to need support from the state, from the federal government. This isn't something, you know, the incident happened in an instant, but the healing is going to take months and years, and it will always be with us.
Absolutely. If there's anything the Spanish United can do on our side, please reach out to us.
Thank you. Will do.
So perfect. So we are to the end of our time. So I want to tell everyone that was listening, thank you for being on the show. And for all the listeners on Spanish United Radio, we are on Spanish United Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, now known as X. We're on YouTube. And again, Mayor, thank you for being on the show. And I will email you the link and you can share with your colleagues.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
That was Working Voice contributor Enrique Sanchez and the latest interview from Spanish United. For more from Enrique Sanchez, you can find Spanish United on the web and at their Spanish United YouTube channel.
1, 2, 3, 4, join the marching jobless corps. Worked and paid our union dues. What did years of that produce? Houses, cars, and other sh** for the richest benefit. What do workers get for pay? Hungry, broke, and thrown away. Hungry, broke, and thrown away.
Next up, Kristen Parker's Education Workers Report Card looks at California Assembly Bill AB 2148, signed into law last week by Governor Newsom, which defines California state policy for human teachers over AI in the classroom.
Numbers, letters, learn to spell, nouns and books, show and tell. Playtime, we will throw the ball and back to class. Through the hall, the teacher marks our height against the wall. Teacher marks our height against the wall. And we don't notice any time.
This is Kristen Parker for Working Voices. And in the latest news regarding AI in the classroom, California has written human teachers into school law. AB 2148 defines public school employees as natural persons. It is not an anti-AI law per se, but California has drawn an unusually simple line in the school AI debate with AB 2148, which states that an employee or contractor at a public TK through 12 school must be a real human being. According to the Transparency Coalition's AI legislative update, Governor Gavin Newsom signed the bill on June 30, 2026, after it passed the Assembly 76-0 and the Senate at 38-0. That may sound almost obvious, but that is exactly why it matters at a time when schools are testing learning software, tutoring chatbots, and automated grading tools, California is putting one principle into law. Technology may assist, but it does not become the teacher. AB 2148 defines terms such as employee, person, or contractor in parts of California's education code as a natural person when they relate to public school work. In practical terms, a school district cannot simply treat an AI system as a school employee in order to fill a role that the law reserves for people. But AB 2148 does not ban all AI in schools. California is separately working on classroom AI guidance, and the California Department of Education has an AI in Education Working Group. Where AB 2148 focuses is on status. Who is legally the person carrying responsibility, working with children, and tied to institutional duties? An important distinction when schools are under pressure with teacher shortages, tight budgets, growing support needs, and new digital expectations that are all arriving at once. Making a cheap chatbot look tempting, especially for tutoring, language practice, or homework feedback. But education is not just a form of answer production. Teachers notice social signals, talk to parents, document risks, intervene in bullying, and carry responsibility toward children. The unanimous legislative path is therefore notable, but still, even lawmakers who do not reject AI in classrooms seem able to agree that the role of a teacher should not be redefined as a software license. For parents, that is a clear signal. For edtech vendors, it is a boundary. Assistance? Yes. Replacement status? No. AB 2148 does not answer every classroom AI question. Privacy, bias, copyright, and procurement remain separate problems. And there is the question where overly cautious interpretation of AB 2148 could make schools avoid harmless tools because they fear a legal risk. California is not saying no to AI in classrooms. It is saying a teacher or school employee is legally a human being. That draws a line between digital tools and real responsibility for children. But it still remains to be seen whether AB 2148 is the right solution to AI in the classroom as time passes and technology improves.
Numbers, letters, learn to spell, nouns and books, show and tell. Playtime, we will throw the ball and back to class, through the hall. The teacher marks our hide against the wall.
As the summer break wears on, and as if LA's education workers don't have enough to worry about, the Los Angeles County Office of Education has placed the Los Angeles Unified School District under increased fiscal oversight after determining the nation's second largest school district may be unable to meet its financial and payroll obligations in the 2027, 28, and 2028-29 fiscal years. The County Education Office cited the cost of recently approved employee contracts, as well as ongoing structural deficits and declining enrollment. The county assigned a fiscal expert to advise the district as it works to address the financial issues identified, and county officials have already warned the designation could lead to additional intervention if the district fails to restore its long-term financial stability. LAUSD Superintendent Andre E. Chait said in a news release last week that the district is committed to working collaboratively with county officials while assuring families that school will continue to operate normally. In its 7-page letter, the County Education Office said that LAUSD's financial outlook deteriorated after the district school board approved new collective bargaining agreements on June 16th, despite previous county warnings that the agreements were not financially sustainable. County officials told the district that the agreements, combined with existing structural deficits and continued enrollment declines, are projected to push the district below the state's minimum reserve requirement and drive its unrestricted general fund to a negative balance of roughly $1.5 billion by 2027-28. This will leave the district with insufficient operating cash to meet payroll and other obligations beginning as early as November 2027, and leaving huge questions under recently negotiated labor contracts for LAUSD teachers, administrators, and staff workers. This is Kristen Parker from the Montebello Teachers Association for Working Voices for KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Numbers, letters, learned to spell, nouns and books, show and tell. Playtime, we would throw the ball and back to class, through the hall. The teacher marks our height against the wall.
That was Kristen Parker with this morning's Education Workers Report Card.
Remind the slaves they ain't gonna make it out alive today. I said, hey, you, poison the well. Watch it all burn, take him straight to hell. He's got the whole world in his hands. It was nice to know you.
KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
And finally, from the KPFK News Desk, Associate Producer Hal Lohr brings us this morning's Working Voices update.
The representative from California has the floor.
Sing out to the resident gas man. Pumped away is your punishment. Pulverize the Eiffel Towers. We'll criticize your government.
Thank you, Marissa. Let's talk tech jobs as San Jose tech company Cisco plans to cut 471 workers in three Bay Area offices, according to layoff notices filed to a state agency. The tech company, which provides networking services along with other services including video conferencing, cybersecurity, and other services, told employees in May that it was going to cut fewer than 4,000 jobs, or less than 5% of its workforce. The notices, processed by the California Employment Development Department this week, provide more details about what jobs Cisco will cut in California. The artificial intelligence boom has fueled more investment in data centers, commercial real estate, and other areas, but advancements in AI tools have also been reshaping jobs, especially in Silicon Valley, the epicenter of the AI tech industry. Cisco's layoffs in California impacted workers in its San Jose, Milpitas, and San Francisco offices, and the company cut a variety of roles in software engineering, product management, design, business operations, and other areas. Cisco said it didn't have anything additional to share beyond what it published in May about its restructuring plans, but tech companies have been citing various reasons for layoffs, including prioritizing investment in artificial intelligence as workers use AI-powered tools to generate code, words, and other content. Some executives have said they simply don't need as many employees. There's also skepticism, though, about how big a role AI is playing at companies with a large amount of workers globally. From January to May, U.S. technology companies announced 123,653 cuts. That's up to 66% from the same period in 2025, according to a June report from the firm Challenger Gray & Christmas. That firm said that AI was the leading reason companies cited for the job cuts, but it still isn't the job apocalypse some predicted. Even as Meta, Snap, Block, Oracle, and Amazon are among tech companies that have announced mass layoffs this year. Cisco markets itself for the AI era and has benefited from the AI boom, reaching a record revenue of $15.8 billion in the third quarter this year alone. And the company's net income grew 35% to $3.4 billion year over year during that quarter. Cisco's chief executive, Chuck Robbins, told employees in May it's cutting costs in certain areas while prioritizing other investments. That includes employee use of AI across the company. As of July 2025, though, Cisco had roughly 86,200 employees, according to its annual report. And in United Auto Workers news, President Sean Fain, who is being investigated by a federal grand jury, has hired two former federal prosecutors who specialize in fraud and bribery cases and work as defense lawyers for a Washington, D.C. firm with a stable of high-profile clients, including trillionaire Elon Musk and former New York City Mayor Eric Adams. The hiring of lawyers Robert Zink and Ben O'Neill of the law firm Quinn, Emanuel, Urquhart, and Sullivan comes amid an investigation focused on allegations Fain pressured another high-ranking union official to secure benefits for his fiancée and her sister, according to the Detroit News. The hirings hint at possible federal crimes being scrutinized in an investigation that increases pressure on the union weeks away from when UAW members will decide whether to elect Fain to a second term as president. The probe also coincides with attempts by the UAW to free itself from a years-long corruption scandal that sent two former UAW presidents, labor leaders, and automotive executives to federal prison. More than a dozen people, including public officials and labor leaders convicted of corruption crimes, have been freed after serving a fraction of their prison sentence in recent years. But the Detroit News reports that no dues money is being used in Fain's defense in connection with the DOJ investigation, at least according to a UAW spokesperson. Zink and O'Neill, on the other hand, work for a firm with a long history with Elon Musk, and in 2023, the firm won a multi-billion-dollar securities trial that ended with jurors concluding Musk and Tesla were not liable for misleading investors. Zink is the former head of the fraud section of the U.S. Justice Department's Criminal Division and acting Deputy Assistant Attorney General, who spent more than a decade prosecuting fraud and bribery cases. That included a 2012 conviction of Miami-area doctors convicted of participating in a $205 million Medicare fraud scheme, the largest such fraud in U.S. history at the time. O'Neill, meanwhile, focuses on white-collar and corporate investigations. During his career as a federal lawyer, he worked foreign bribery, financial, and healthcare fraud. The hiring signal a concern for Fain, said Harley Shaken, a labor expert and professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, indicating concerns about where this might go when you hire attorneys at that level. After all, they're very expensive. But it doesn't reflect guilt, they say. That's for a judge or a jury to decide.
So if some debt is good, but too much debt can be bad, when does it become bad, bad, like unsustainable bad?
If the publicly held debt goes above roughly 175% of GDP, things get pretty hard at that point, and 200% is really the drop dead limit. And the reason why is once you hit that limit, you couldn't possibly raise taxes enough at that point to meet the interest payments.
And finally, in the debate about the level, the United States' $39 trillion ticking time bomb national debt poses to the economy, most people can agree that any crisis will be felt most sharply by the youngest people in the economy. For example, Citadel CEO Ken Griffith has previously warned that surging debt is an issue the government cannot afford to ignore anymore, writing in his 2023 letter to the shareholders that it is irresponsible for the U.S. government to incur a deficit of 6.4% when unemployment is hovering around 3.75%. We must stop borrowing at the expense of future generations. A report published yesterday by the Peter G. Peterson Foundation suggests that Gen Z in particular will face a smaller job market with lower wages if the fiscal trajectory of the country continues to persist. However, the think tank has outsourced some of its data analysis, which found that the rising debt path will reduce the number of jobs in the U.S. by 1.2 million by 2035, compared to a scenario in which lawmakers can actually stabilize the debt. By 2055, on an annual and cumulative basis, this adds up to 2.7 million jobs and a loss of 3.6 million jobs by 2075. Of course, 50 years into the future, it is Gen Z and Gen Alpha who will make up the bulk of the workforce. An optimist might suggest that by 2075, the economy could survive with fewer jobs thanks to the efficiencies provided by artificial intelligence, where it's possible that economically developed nations will end up with a work week of 3.5 days. But many expert individuals are worried about how America's borrowing habit may come home to roost, seeing a bond market crisis as the most likely outcome as the U.S. economy navigates the upheaval, not being the ideal way to deal with the national debt as an issue. And the analysis commissioned by the Peterson Foundation also found that take-home pay shrinks over time if policymakers don't slow the pace of debt accumulation. The annual difference in wage compared to a stabilized debt baseline drops by 0.6% by 2035, 3% by 2055, and 5.3% by 2075, particularly when the service payments to manage the U.S. debt are accumulating at speed. Recent research from the Congressional Budget Office found net interest on public debt for the fiscal year has hit $857 billion. And in case you're keeping score, that's roughly $24 billion a week in interest that the federal government can't use in the public good. In fact, the interest payments on the debt are now $20 billion larger than the outlay for the Departments of Defense, Commerce, Homeland Security, Education, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Small Business Administration combined. The report concludes that younger people, those that the report believes will be most impacted by debt, must now work to ensure policymakers take action by making their voices heard. Because for younger working class people, the growing national debt will both shrink the labor market and drive down wages, contributing to an uncertain economic future for millions of workers, where the decisions that today's leaders are making about America's fiscal future are extremely consequential to the next generation.
And that's our show for this week. Once again, we're asking our labor partners, locals, and regional officers to seriously consider underwriting this show, because Working Voices and KPFK can really use your support. So please contact the station at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org to explore the possibilities. We need to hear from you. You can also email your comments or questions to workingvoices@aol.com. Please contribute if you can at 818-985-5735. Once again, this is Joe Ayala.
And this is Marissa Rimsky.
Our special thanks to Dan McCrory, Steve Zeltzer, Gary Scott, Enrique Sanchez, Christian Parker, Hal Lohr, and of course, all of our guests. Please contribute and give what you can to keep us going. We're in this together. And of course, always remember to educate, agitate, and organize. Have a great day, everybody.
Got so much work, yeah, yeah.
In a world filled with corporate media, predictable sound bites, and endless commercials, there's still a place for independent truth. That place is KPFK. And on Tuesday, July 21st, our summer fun drive officially begins. We know you tune in for the hard-hitting news, deep cultural insights, and music you won't hear anywhere else. You don't tune in to hear us ask for money. That's why our goal this summer is simple. Keep the fundraising days to an absolute minimum. Your early support is the end engine that powers this station and keeps the fun drives short. Call us now at 818-985-5735 and press option 2. That's 818-985-KPFK, option 2. If you prefer, skip the phone lines entirely. Make your secure, tax-deductible donation online at kpfk.org/donate. Free speech isn't free. It's listener-funded. Keep KPFK strong, independent, and commercial-free. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your support.
This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics and author